I've gotten emails from people in Thailand.
You've received over 1 million views on YouTube.
That's right. I think it's somewhere around 600,000 of them are attached to 3 fence-related videos that this is property no one ever purchased.
We've taken time just to talk about farming. We're here to talk about YouTube, but I really wanted the audience to get a sense that you've built a brand.
Conversations, interviews, rants, and discussions about society, technology, food, art, culture, games, music, education, business, community building and marketing, communications, board games, old science, new cars, body piercing, body painting, competitive eaters, zombies and vampires, and more. You're listening to Talking About Everything with Harry Hawk.
Hello, this is Harry Hawk from Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey, and today we're talking with Tommy Alderman from Alderman Farms. His slogan is "Where pasture makes perfect." And if you're wondering why on a show that focuses on YouTube and streaming media, why we'd be talking to a farmer, well, you definitely want to listen. Tommy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like people to get a little sense of your background. Can you give us a, you know, sort of a 30 seconds on where you've been and how you got into farming?
Sure. You may have to throw a flag because I don't know if I can do it in 30 seconds. But I grew up in Baker, Louisiana, which is a suburb basically of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. My wife, who is about 4 years younger than I, also grew up there. After we were married, we moved to the outskirts of the city there. And we had 4 kids at the time, all under the age of 10. And for the first time, the price of a gallon of milk hit $4. Now, being from where you are, you're probably thinking, yeah, that happened here in the 60s. But it didn't happen in Louisiana in the 60s. This was the mid-90s. And my wife said, oh, no, this is not going to work. We had a 2.5 acres, and my wife said, if we're going to pay $4 for a gallon of milk, it's going to be worth it. We're getting some goats. It's a long story that that I can tell you later if you want to hear about some of it's humorous about that happened. But normally chickens are the gateway drug in the farming. People start with chickens and it starts from there. But with us, it started with goats.
I know with goats, you get a lot of milk and a lot of fertilizer.
Yeah. I don't know if you get a lot of milk. We have Jersey cows now, so, you know, now we do get a lot of milk. But I was in law enforcement at the time. My wife's name is Patty, and she loved to camp. Her father instilled a love of camping in her. And so we had been driving up to Mississippi to a federal park, a state park, excuse me, somehow connected to the federal park system. But anyway, I'm still confused about that, called Clear Springs. And we would camp there, had a great time. And I knew that my family had property just outside of Brookhaven, Mississippi. I'd been a couple of times. Frankly, my parents, neither of them had very fond memories because they were Depression children. Their memories of the land in Mississippi was working, you know, waking up 30 minutes before they went to bed kind of thing and to work. But anyway, on one of those camping trips, I told Patty, I said, you know what? We've got some property not far from here. It was about 30 minutes from where we were camping. Let's go check it out. She fell in love with it. We started camping. We built a little cabin on deep in the woods on the site where the original home had been. Now, understand, this is property no one ever purchased. It's been in my family for over 150 years now, given to my great-great-grandfather in a land grant. So we built that cabin, and we eventually spent a week in that cabin over an Easter break. We were already homeschooling our children. We could have done it any time, but we did it on the Easter break. So we spent a week up here, not just in the woods. We came into the town of Brookhaven, and it was just quaint, and we were enchanted. But when we went back home, Harry, it was as if scales had fallen off of my eyes. Let me back up for a moment. Before that trip, I was Mr. Optimism. I was Mr. Silver Lining guy. When other guys in the department were seeing trends in the city heading downward, violence increasing, things happening like that, they would come to me and I was the guy who could point out the bright side and say, oh, it's not that bad. Think of this. Well, you could ask my wife if she was here. This is the truth. As we are driving back into our hometown after having been up here for a week during a cleansing that I didn't know had happened, I suddenly saw things I had never noticed before. My mouth was agape. And as we pulled into our driveway, before I ever even turned the key off of the car, I said, we've got to get our kids out of here. You know, within a matter of months, we were making plans. And we moved up here in 2000 and have never looked back. And with the we have 116 acres of land. My great-great-grandfather got an entire section, which is 640. And out of that 640, between my first cousins and I, we still control over 400 of that original 640. But 116 of it is mine. My dad went ahead and deeded it to me. My one sister, who's awesome, didn't want it. She said, we don't have to split it. You know, it's you do it. I'm a city girl. We slowly began expanding to adding a few more goats, our, you know, chickens. And
let me cut you off there and say, just can you give us a kind of a rundown of what animals and what crops and so forth, where you are today? We're in February of 2015.
Let me say this by way of transition. During all of that time, we considered ourselves homesteaders, not farmers. As time has and culture has changed, there is a growing number of folks out there who think more like us in terms of the food that they eat. They don't mind eating meat, but they want to know that the animals were cared for and loved on and treated well, humanely, no hormones and yada, yada, yada. As you know, we added Jersey cows for milk for ourselves, a few more dairy goats for milk for ourselves and others, huge vegetable gardens, lots of chickens, and we sell eggs and chickens for meat. My passion is the American guinea hog. I'm not going to start talking about them, Harry, because you do not have time. But
we'll get to that maybe later, I guess.
Yeah, people can go to my YouTube channel and see all they want to see about American guinea hogs. But it's a small heritage pig, basically.
For eating, for?
Yes, we sell some for breeding purposes, but mostly it's for – we've made a connection with a local chef in Jackson, Mississippi, which is – capital of Mississippi, and it's just about 45 minutes north of us. And he said he'll buy all that I can raise. So we're really in a position right now to be expanding our herd.
What's the weight of a ready to go to market American guinea hog?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that. If you know, the typical market weight for a hog is 200 to 220. Some will say 150 to 200 or something like that. To get a guinea hog to that weight, you're looking at 2 years to get a guinea hog to 200 pounds. But fortunately for us, when you're talking about marketing to chefs, they're not interested in a hog that big. They're interested in a 50, 60, 70 pound hog. And for us, that's about 6 months to get a pig to that size, whereas a traditional hog at 6 months would be 220.
In other days and times, I've sold a lot of whole hogs through the summer here in New York, and we would look for something around 80 to 100 pounds for what we were doing. But that makes sense, that a chef needs to know that he can sell whatever he's going to get from that animal, and a couple hundred pounds of meat could just be way too much for him to handle in right. terms of, you know, he'd really have to break it down, and he wouldn't be able to do a whole hog dish. But either way, broken down or all together, 6 months and then to market, obviously you're going to market twice a year. Does the breeding cycle keep up with that?
We let them breed on their own. By the schedule that they pick. We're very hands off. A sow can, if she's ready and up to it, you know, she could actually farrow 3 times a year. Now they have small litters. I don't want to get off in the weeds because there's so many things to say about them, but they do have small litters, typical is 6 to 8. But let me tell you the most interesting and beneficial characteristic about them is they are highly efficient foragers. We give them the run of the place. They're docile, so they're not wild. They don't try to escape. We use hot wire to electrified wire to contain them, and it works very well. Unless I have them confined for one of several reasons. When the mamas are farrowing, I have them in a smaller area for protection from predators. When I'm training them to the young ones to a hot wire, I'll have them confined. When they're confined, I have to feed them. When they're not confined, I don't. People find that hard to believe, but they are such efficient foragers. And that
makes sense. And between that and the goats, I imagine your property is looking pretty spick and span.
Yeah, it really is. And their meat is marbled. It has little balls of fat in the meat. It's really, really unique, a unique meat.
Well, I'm going to have to get you to send one up to New York for one of my favorite chefs to work on. But that's another story.
All righty.
We've taken, you know, a chunk of time just to talk about farming. Now, this is not a farming show. We're here to talk about YouTube. But I really wanted the audience to get a sense that you know what you're doing and that you've built a brand. It's really important, obviously, for the smallest and the largest company to be well-branded. But when you're selling local food to local people, it's really critical, obviously, that they have some kind of connection to you. And you have a connection to them, right? That's gives the trust in your product. You've received over 1 million views on YouTube.
That's right.
So, and that took you, I guess, about 2.5 to 3 years to get there.
Right.
How are you using YouTube? And you've got a partner in this?
Carbon Media Group.
What are you getting out of YouTube? Why did you partner with Carbon Media? And where is it taking you? How is it helping you farm better or homestead better?
We uploaded our first video in March of 2012, and it was a how to set a corner post without concrete. And if you Google that phrase, I'm number one on Google. It went crazy that there are, of those 1 million views, I think it's somewhere around 600,000 of them are attached to three fence-related videos that I have. How to set a corner post without concrete, how to tighten a fence with nothing but pliers, and how to a homemade device to help you stretch fence. We really didn't have any purpose. We just
Tell me again. So these are viral videos, basically.
Well, I wouldn't say viral. I'll tell you, if we have time, I'll tell you a story about getting hitched up with a viral video and what it did for us one weekend in April, one April. I wouldn't say that they're viral, but they just are well played. And, you know, they have a, in that same time period where we've got, look at it this way, I've got over, and I don't know the number, 260 videos, somewhere north of 260, okay? And with 1,040,000 views, that spread over 200 videos, but 600,000 of those views are on three. And that's been since 2012, you know. So again, I don't think that meets the criterion to call them viral, but I just think it's funny that I still get the most of my comments are on those views. I've gotten emails from people in Thailand who have watched I've got subscribers in 110 different countries, mostly because of those videos and helping rural people. We didn't set out to do that. We didn't set out to do anything. But just share some knowledge that our old neighbor in Louisiana, who kind of got us started down the homesteading path, taught us some tricks and thought, wouldn't it be neat to share this? But eventually I found out that nowadays when a person, I think what I'm about to say is correct. If a person who doesn't have a YouTube channel starts up a YouTube channel today, I believe they can become the same day a YouTube partner. Back when in 2012, it wasn't the case. You had to have some, I don't know what it was, if there was some kind of benchmark that they would ask you to become a partner and with YouTube. And all that meant was that you would agree to allow them to put advertisements on your videos and they would share the revenue with you. You had to set up an AdSense account with Google. And so we did that. I thought, hey, that'd be fun to have a dollar or two coming in. In March, I think of March 2012, Well, you know what? I messed that story up. I had an old YouTube channel. Somewhere around the time we started the Alderman Farms YouTube channel is when they rolled out the partner program to just about anybody. So we partnered up with them that very month. And I think we earned 37 cents that month. And YouTube AdSense they didn't pay until you banked $100, you know. But
I have two questions for you, Tommy. One is, are any of these videos going out to the local community? And then where did the Carbon Media Group come into this, and when did you get involved with them?
What do you mean by going out to the local community?
In other words, do you think any of the people around you in Mississippi are watching these videos? I mean, when you're looking at the statistics and stuff, are you seeing some local viewership?
Well, I'm
or is
terrible.
It more international?
I'm terrible about tracking, paying attention to analytics. I just don't have time. Occasionally, I'll get in there and look, and I know that makes me a bad YouTuber. And I'm going to get demerits from the YouTube wizards who are going to listen to this and say, shake their finger at me. But I don't have time to do that. I can't answer the question. I know that they do, because it's so funny when I go to conferences, not YouTube related. I'm talking about farm conferences in the state of Mississippi, wearing my Alderman Farms T-shirt. Hey, are you the guy with the, you know, I mean, it's like I'm not like a rock star. I don't have groupies. But it never fails that every conference we go to, at least, and more than one, at least a handful of people will come up to me and say, hey, I'll watch your YouTube videos. You're the guy with the corner post, you know, blah, blah, blah. And in fact, we got a call last Tuesday. There was a conference that I had been to in the past and wasn't able to go to. During this conference for growers, producers in the state of Mississippi, a young lady from Mississippi State University presented a class on social media, and we got phone calls saying that she used us as the example of how to use social media to promote, to market your products and promote your farm, because we do YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. So yeah, we're having local impact, encouraging. I've talked to, I don't know how many, not hundreds, but you know, more than 10 farmers who are interested in how to do what we're doing to help. Just to give you a clue, tying Facebook into this conversation with YouTube, because it all works together. We post our videos on Facebook. We grew our first batch of meat chickens for sale. We did a small run because we didn't know how it was going to work out. We had 57 for sale. Put some videos on showing them how they, you know, how they were living, you know, free out in the grass. Yep. But she posted it on Facebook and within minutes had sold 35 of them at a premium price. It was amazing. We were appalled, and we thought, gosh, why didn't we get 100? You asked me about Carbon Media. When you reach some plateau of viewership or earnings or something, you start, as a YouTuber, you start getting invitations from, hey, we're this network, and we like what you're doing and whatnot. And so as far as my earnings go, we made 37 cents the first month, and it doubled for the first year. It doubled almost every month. We were getting a lot of play with the fencing videos and whatnot. And so they just reached out, and there's a friend of mine in Meridian, Mississippi, about 3 hours away from here, was getting into YouTube, and they reached out to him. And so we, based on our conversations with the company of what they could offer us, and I'd be happy to explain that.
Yeah, I'd love to know what they offered you and all of that.
Our YouTube network, meaning the Carbon Media folks, Outdoor Hub is another, and Ag Hub is some of their channels or whatnot. Here's the thing that they offer, and I'm not allowed to talk about the actual numbers,
okay,
but they do offer a little higher rate. They sell advertising aggressively for their member YouTube channels. So it's a little bit of a higher rate. So I'll leave it at that. But here's the most important thing. They have direct connection. That's a Mississippi word, direct. They have direct connection with YouTube folks. So if I've got something happening on my channel or a question, if I just got a, let me put it to you this way, somebody who's not involved with a network like them, good luck trying to get a hold of YouTube folks. You know, all you're going to get is sent, you're going to get stuck in the help file. And now look, YouTube's got great, their creator's playbook is golden. Helping you set up a channel. So there's, that sounded kind of like I was denigrating YouTube. I didn't mean it that way at all. But good luck trying to speak to a human. These networks, at least ours, Carbon Media, they've got YouTube contacts. So if I've got a question that I can't answer and Carbon Media can't answer, they've got people at YouTube they can speak to get answers.
That's great.
And, oh, I'm telling you, that's worth the price of admission, which is zero, by the way. It doesn't cost me anything to be a part of it. But I've been totally pleased because, forgive me, I can't remember what the questions were, but there have been at least three times when I needed to know something from YouTube, and all I had to do was send an email to my contact at Carbon Media, and within a couple of days, he had an answer.
And so you think, back to the – not again, I understand you can't go into super specifics – but you think in terms of revenue out of this, it's a better deal for you than just being partnered with YouTube by the, you know, one-on-one with them?
So far, yes. So far, yes. Because it's a higher cost per CPM.
Cost per thousand CPM.
Yeah, cost per thousand. It's a higher. And
do they help you promote it all as well? Are they, besides selling the ads, or is that really on you, so to speak?
There is some promotion through their channels, but I don't worry about that. I mean, I got news for you. I'm telling you, if it didn't make me another nickel, if it didn't make me a nickel more than I would make without them, I would still partner with them for the access to YouTube folks.
Well, that's a great endorsement, Tommy. You know, we're coming down to sort of the wire here on the time that I've got for this show. So try to keep it down to around 25 to 30 minutes. Do you have time today to go into overtime?
Sure. Well, can we talk about pigs?
Talk about the American guinea pigs and everything else.
Guinea hogs.
And yeah. We can talk about chicken grit and anything else you like.
Yeah. All right.
If you could just briefly tell me again what YouTube means to your business. Not to your family, not necessarily to the community, but just wearing the business hat that says you got to sell more than your costs and, you know, that you've got to expand your business over time. Can you just talk a little bit, just briefly, about how YouTube contributes to that?
Certainly brand awareness. We have a following. And as I demonstrated by the contacts I've had at these conferences where people recognize us from our YouTube channel, it's working. We have a local awareness of who we are. Our logo is recognizable through in our state to a certain degree. So it's helped with brand awareness. It's helped with, where pasture makes perfect for us, it doesn't mean that I've got the lushest of pastures. That's not it. The idea that we are promoting with that logo and that slogan is that our animals eat naturally, feed them artificially, and things of that nature. And so YouTube helps us to flesh that out. They see us loving our animals. They see me down on the ground with my pigs, giving them belly rubs. You know, they see us speaking kindly to our critters. And so that all gives us credibility to people who are looking for a source of food that they can trust. If that makes sense. We also make a little money from YouTube. It's not a big at all. It's only, you know, a couple $100 a month right now. Now it's increasing. We hope it continues to, but that helps offset the cost of feed for the dairy goats, for the Jersey, for the milk cows. We do have to feed them some to produce their milk. So it helps offset those type expenses.
I need to wrap this up and we'll go into overtime. Again, my name is Harry Hawk. You can find me on Twitter at HHAWK, and you can find this and other podcasts on the FIR podcast network, and you can communicate with the whole community on Google Plus on the FIR podcast forum. Tommy, can you tell everybody where they can find you and Alderman Farms?
Yep, pretty simple. Everything is Alderman Farms. YouTube, Alderman Farms. Facebook, Alderman Farms. Twitter, at Alderman Farms. Instagram, at Alderman Farms.
And you're on Pinterest as well, I believe?
Yes, we are. And, you know, it's a shame. I forget that because we haven't been as faithful as we should. But Pinterest is Alderman Farms, and aldermanfarms.net is our website.
Well, that's great, Tommy. I thank you so much for being here today. We're about to go over time. If you want to hear more from Tommy, look for the link to the raw and uncut version of this podcast. Again, this is Harry Hawk saying, I hope you have a great week. All right, Tommy, we're in overtime. So,
all right.
What should we talk about?
I'd love to tell you the story about how we got connected with a viral video.
Okay.
And the effect that it had.
Fantastic.
The YouTube changed some things about the way they reported, about the way they report their statistics. There was a time, I don't remember how long ago it's been now, but let's see. I think this was in 2013 when you could find all kind of apps for your iPhone or Android that you could connect to your YouTube analytics and get some fairly real-time stats. And I did that. I wasn't, I wasn't anal about it. I wasn't checking every 5 minutes, but I would, throughout the day, I would look up there, and I mean, they would even give you your estimated earnings. This was before we were connected to the Carbon Media Network. So I knew what my normal daily activity was, and I don't remember the numbers at the time, but we were this particular weekend. This was April. Weekend of April the 20th, I think, in 2013, we were in Orange Beach, Alabama with our youngest daughter at a cheer competition, competitive cheer competition. And at some point in the day, I checked my stats and they were a little higher than they normally were. I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. Well, a couple hours later, I checked it again and they were skyrocketing. Let's just say I don't remember the numbers, but let's just say thousands instead of hundreds. It was that big of a difference. And I check it again a little while later and it was going through the roof. Well, my initial reaction was, hey, that's pretty cool. My second reaction was after checking it a few times was, uh-oh, because I had heard at the time about people deploying click bots that would cause it to look like to YouTube and Google like you were clicking on your own ads, which is a big no-no, or getting your friends and family to, hey, go click my ads, you know, because that's how you make money. And so I got to the hotel room. I fired off an email to YouTube or Google or whoever and said, hey, it's not me. And thankfully, that email address, somebody replied and they said, hey, we know it's not you. We appreciate that. We're looking into it. We can tell. Rest assured, we can tell when it's nefarious. And so anyway, over the next couple of days, it just went huge. I mean, I was having like 70,000 views in a day when I was normally having 30,000 a month at that time. And YouTube analytics lag a couple of days behind. So you can't go, I couldn't, it was going to be like the next week before I could go see what was happening. And a friend of mine, the friend I mentioned earlier who was getting into YouTube, suggested it'll be interesting to see where the clicks are coming from. So we get back home, the analytics catch up, and I go and look, and I see that the clicks were coming from my fencing videos. The three fencing videos. What had happened, Harry? This was the weekend, and this is not a light subject. So don't misunderstand. I'm not making light of it. Was the weekend right after the Boston Marathon bombing, and someone had posted a 9-second video clip called FBI Fence Jump. And it was an amusing little clip of an FBI agent struggling to climb over a gate that had pointy things on the top. So he was, you can just imagine he was being very careful, struggling to climb over this gate. He finally gets over the gate, puts his feet on the ground, and as he starts walking away, the gate swings open. It was unlocked. So it was an amusing little thing, and it was only 9 seconds long, and it went viral, and it went legitimately viral. 9 million views that weekend. Well, guess what?
Because we're looking for other fence videos.
Well, YouTube threw up my fence videos as suggested videos at the end of that little 9 second clip because of the same language, the same words were used. And so
obviously not really related at all, but that's automation for you.
Yeah. So that weekend when we were normally making, 150 to, we would scream with delight if we made $200 a month. We made $600 in AdSense that weekend just from that. And, the video itself got 9 million views. We got, close to 80,000. So a pittance of the overall views, but we actually made a blog post called Riding the Wave, it was crazy.
Well, this is, I don't know if you may know the term. I wouldn't want to assume you do or you don't, but do you know the term long tail key?
No, I don't.
Long tail string.
No.
In other words, with search terms, there's the ones that are really common, around February, how to find a CPA, do your taxes, right? What's the best pizza in Chicago? Those are all short tail keys, keywords or strings. But the long tails are these ones that are very narrow and very specific. And they don't come up very often. But when they do, Google loves to have somebody to put out there. So if you can imagine someone typing in, how do I stretch my fence wire? And it's like, and you've hit the gold standard because so many people have seen it. They know that there can't be anything better. And the good news is it's really unlikely that somebody else is going to try to make that same content to compete with you as opposed to pizza joints in Chicago competing with each other.
Right.
So that's really neat. I know that there are different audiences, different in marketing. We talk about different segments. You have your local community, local state segment of people who are watching, but it's great. You mentioned that you have viewers in Thailand and so forth. So to me, that's really a great form of give back to the worldwide community to, how do you set up a fence without cement? And you said in the corner post or?
Oh, listen, I have been literally moved to tears. But Thailand is always front of mind because it was an email that I got from a man in Thailand who literally told me, Harry, he said, sir, you have no idea how many thousands of lives that you have affected. And he said, the rural people can sustain themselves with agriculture, but they need fencing. But concrete is an impossibility for them.
It's very expensive, I would imagine.
Very expensive and very, very difficult to transport. And so he said, and it was a very detailed thing, and I could hear the passion in what he was typing. And I'm sitting there thinking, as I'm reading this thing, he is sending this email to me. To me? What? from that little video. And I broke all the YouTube rules at the time. It's 11 minutes long. I've got title screens that are way too – things I would never do again, things I've learned about that I shouldn't do. And people watched through those long titles, and it was just amazing. I mean, I had tears in my eyes when I called my wife over and said, read this. And that's just one. I mean, we've gotten emails from Finland and Japan, 110 different countries. So I haven't gotten emails from all of those, but France, I've gotten emails. Canada, Japan, I've gotten emails. It's just amazing. Little country boy in Brookhaven, Mississippi, and it's really humbling to see that the things. Harry, our grandparents knew how to do some stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing that those little tips can really have an impact in somebody's life. I mean, really affect their quality of life. I never dreamed in my wildest dreams that showing somebody how to set a post without concrete would affect someone's quality of life half on the other side of the world. Amazing.
Well, that is, you've told us some great stories here today, and YouTube is all about storytelling, and which is sort of, I'd like to get into that topic, but I think it's just amazing when we can reach out and do some good, even if it's just entertainment. But this mm-hmm. is a case that it's beyond that. It's actual, you know, some practical knowledge. And yes, you know, our grandparents, great grandparents did stuff. I have a copper pot that my great grandfather made. You know, I look at it and imagine it could take me my whole life to try to replicate that. You know?
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. You know, it's interesting how, and stop me if you want to go somewhere else, but it's interesting how our YouTube channel has evolved. Our idea to begin with was basically tips, you know, how to just to do. That's all we had in mind was how to videos, but it's evolved and our audience has become, you know, I know we get traffic from people searching for how to do certain things, but we've also got a society of voyeurs. I don't mean that negatively, but
they want to see the farm life.
Right. They, you know, I've had people tell me that they live their dream life vicariously through my videos. Because it, you know, so the channel evolved from strictly our original concept of an instructional channel to, a combination of instructional videos. This is our life kind of thing. You know, we've got, some of Patty's recipes, on there.
I saw a biscuit recipe that I thought.
Oh yeah,
great.
Boy, you need to try that biscuit mix.
And by the way, we would call that food porn.
Yeah, that's right.
Because there's no narration; it's just music and food. So
yeah,
and I'm the co-creator of the New York City Food Film Festival.
Oh come on!
We have an entire category called food porn, which it has a range, and occasionally there are some words. But what we love best is these short little videos that, you know, someone does something artistic with food or interesting with food and some music.
Yeah. Interesting. So, you know, people love to see the baby pigs and they love to see the little goats, baby goats jumping up on, you know, so I've got a playlist called Critter Cinema, you know, so homestead humor, you know, we've done some, I constantly forget to collect all my outtakes. We just started mushroom. We inoculated our first shiitake logs, trying to grow some mushrooms, and I had to start over on it because a dog interfered, and I tagged it onto the end of the video, and you know, so it's just evolved to sharing what we do with people, sharing what we love, showing people that, you know, you can love and respect your animals with the understanding that eventually they're going to provide sustenance for you or someone else. That's not pleasant. I don't. And one of the things that there are some channels that I appreciate, Harry, so I'm not knocking them. I appreciate the channels that show you how to humanely kill a pig. Because I've looked at them and needed to see and some things. And so I appreciate those. That's not us. We thought about that. You know, would we show that? And I don't think so. I don't think my audience wants that. And so anytime we talk about those type things or any videos related to that, the death is not something that we're wanting to show. Everybody understands that it happens. You know, we're not Pollyanna. That's what they're for. But again, our job is to not ignore what these animals' ultimate purpose is, but to give them the best life possible. Make them as comfortable, honor their nature. Joel Salatin calls it respecting the pigness of a pig, for example.
Yes.
So that means no rings in the noses. Pigs are born to root around, and rings in their noses are designed to prevent that. Why would I do that? Why would I want to prevent something that's in there to allow them to, that is designed by God to allow them to express their nature, you know? So anyway, I'm rambling now.
Well, that you know, I think, you know, my own involvement here in New York at times as a restaurateur, I teach hospitality. You know, this view is becoming more and more common. It's a lot harder to do that in New York City.
Sure.
So these products are going into much more higher end establishments. And
that's right.
But, you know, it over time, you know, there's research that shows that small family farms are nearly as productive as these large farms. So if we could get more farmers and break up more larger farms, you know, we're not going to lose much. And if it, you know, if they were a third of the efficiency, you might say, well, people have to eat. But given that they're nearly identical, and that the quality is so much better. But you know, for a restaurant that I had, I used to get, some elk meat, out of Idaho. You know, and that was always fun to put that on the menu in Brooklyn and to talk about it and use a local smokehouse to get sausages and so forth. So I think you'll find, that, you know, you are on the right side of history and you're on the right side of culture of, you know, that what you're doing besides obviously providing for your family is providing for many families. And that's something I certainly thank you for and thank all of the folks who are out there farming. I know it's a hard life. I had a guy who worked for me, Tommy's worked for me 5 days a week, 6 days a week, you know, 14, 15 hours a day, at a summer place that we had, a summer restaurant. And he'd go upstate for the day he had off, you know, to work on his father's farm. So
yeah.
You know, farm life makes good people.
Yeah, it's an honest, you know, it's an honest living, as they used to say. But, you know, the feel good side of all of that, you just mentioned right side of history, right side of the culture, and we're very, very glad for that. But I'll tell you something else. From a business standpoint, we're also on the right spot on the train, if that makes sense. Yep. You know, because that's right. But what I meant was trend wise, I mentioned this briefly earlier. There's a growing number of people who are becoming aware of that. Hey, maybe I should care about where my food comes from and what not just animals but vegetables too. You know, maybe I should care how my food is grown. And from a purely business perspective, the interesting thing about most of the folks who are in that category is they have money. They don't mind spending. They don't mind spending paying a premium price for a product if it meets their needs. And the number of people that fit in that category is rapidly growing. You see that with the thanks to groups like. You familiar? I'm sure you are. Slow Food USA,
yes.
And others like it.
Here in New York, we have Just Foods, which tries to source food from for New York. It's a 300-mile radius, but in some places, you know, people try to get a 100-mile radius.
Yeah, yeah.
I once did a 1-mile salad at a place because we were on an island and they had a small farm and we had a restaurant there. And we recycled the pre-consumer waste back to the farm.
Mm, nice.
But,
yeah,
it's you know, there's a term in marketing called high scoop marketing. Tesla does this. You say, we want to get started with a product, and the first ones are going to be more expensive than what we can make later on. And so, you know, you could take a different kind of view and have government subsidies to get over that first go-to-market costs, but with high scoop marketing, you sell to people who can afford it. So you've seen the Tesla cars come down. Eventually, they'll you know, they'll get from 90,000 maybe down to 40,000, which is still an expensive car, but it's a whole different market at 40,000. And sure. And I think farming, you know, the kind of product that you're making over time will eventually come down, or people, you know, people will look for it for a special meal or a holiday, you know, that in season when the prices are at their lowest, that people will seek it out and so forth.
Yeah. Well, we've been one of the problems we face is pricing our products. And we are limited by what my wife is willing to pay. and that hurts us, you know, because we're having to learn to get over that. For example, when we did our first little batch of meat birds, now we had planned on, our plan was to price them per pound. And so we started seeking out a digital price calculating scale that could be certified by the state for farmers markets and all that. We had no idea the universe we were stepping into, and that there were a bazillion options on Amazon and elsewhere. So it made our head hurt, and we just stopped, and Patty said, I'm just going to sell them, you know, for a flat rate of $12 a bird. Well, we found out later that we grossly undercharged that's the price that those people snatched up 35 of them. And yeah, it wasn't a bunch of people. Harry, there was one lady bought 8 of them at $12 a piece. Another lady bought a couple more, brought 6. You know, these people were paying. And listen, my wife would never pay $12 for 8 chickens. I mean, you know, she would say, we're going to start raising some, which and we're not going to do that. But once we found out that we were undercharging, Patty went back to several of those customers who had bought at 12 and asked them, would they have bought them at 15? And all but one of them said, yeah. And we're like, wow.
Well, you know, again, Economics 101 would say, next time you have a new product or you want to find a price, find a way to do a little auction for the first batch, and the market will tell you.
That's not a bad idea.
And then to get really geeky into this, there's a Dutch auction, which is, you say you have 5 of them. So mm-hmm. the 5 highest prices, mm-hmm. the 5 highest bids win.
Ah.
And what Google did with their stock is the reverse Dutch auction. So your wife might like this. So you take those so you have 5, whatever it is, 5 meat chickens. So, you know, someone bids 15, someone bids 16, 17, 18, and maybe the highest price someone was willing to pay, 22. So with a Dutch auction, all 5 of them would get it. Anybody who bid lower wouldn't. In the reverse Dutch auction, those same 5 get the chicken, but they pay the price of the 5th cheapest one.
Huh.
So you don't, you know, there's some incentive to bid a little bit extra because you may not have to pay that if you know.
I like that. That's pretty sneaky, Harry.
This is how, you know, that's how Google priced their stock, and it sold a lot higher than a lot of other startup stocks. But they also found people who were really interested in that long term relationship, not
like
looking
that
to flip it. And sometimes, you know, and this could throw it off a little bit as a pricing mechanism if you did it for a charity or something. But then people might spend a little bit too much just for the benefit of the charity, which is good for the charity, but it doesn't tell you what people are really willing to pay.
Right. Well, and I realize too, for you've got listeners, and you know who knows where they are, but certainly, I mean, I have no idea what a free range bird a pasture raised chicken would go for in your local market. You may have scoffed at you know, $12. We couldn't buy a foot for $12. But in our market, I was talking to somebody about what I just described to you about selling them for $12, having customers say they would have paid $15. And this man told me, he said, I studied business, and I in my marketing class, I don't remember a lot, but this I remember. He said the professor in that class said, when you have an item to sell that costs, that is valued at $20 or less, some, you know, no more than $20, He said, you price it based on a $20 bill, not based on the actual item itself. And he said, he went on to explain, and this makes perfect sense to me as a man who has walked into a place with a $20 bill in my hand. It makes perfect sense to me. Mm-hmm. If a person comes into a place expecting to buy something and has a $20 bill in his hand, it doesn't matter to him whether the price is 12 or 17, as long as it's not more than 20. Yep. You know, he said that man will hand you that $20 bill if he wants that. Of course, the idea is he has to want the item. And I know that's true. I've purchased things that that cost 17 and it wouldn't have, or should I say 14, and it wouldn't have mattered to me one whit had it actually cost 17. Why? Because I had a $20 bill in my hand. So
this is the, you know, economically, that elasticity of demand that, you know, within a certain range, people will pay what they'll pay. And but when it starts to get beyond that, then the demand starts to go down and you're looking for that sweet spot that gives you a good size cohort of potential buyers without, you know, blocking things out. But then in your case, because you're not a factory, there's a cycle and a process and a cost to everything that you do, you know, how you maximize that, you know, can really matter to your family. And, but you know, this is the hard part of being in business, you have to price your stuff and, it's not always easy.
No, it's not, because we want to make our food accessible to as many people as we can. We're not trying to have some champagne market, or I just made that up. I don't know if that means anything, but you know, we're not trying to get rich off of the backs of the well-to-do. That's not it. But at the same time, we have to be able to afford to provide the food. You know, we've got to make the cold hard truth of any endeavor is, if it's not profitable, you're not going to keep doing it. So we've got to find, as you mentioned earlier, that sweet spot in pricing that allows us to make a profit that we can feel good about, to allow us to expand or whatnot, and while not at the same time too much bottlenecking the boy, I'm just stumbling all over. You know what I'm trying to say. Put it out of reach of too many people. We don't want that to happen.
You know, there's a lot of different strategies, and you know, you can in some product decide that you can get a good price for it, and you can use your excess profit, as economists would say, to donate something or give something for no cost to someone who truly deserves it. But it's good to have a range of products. There's a reason 30% of McDonald's customers buy the value menu, and I'm certainly not linking your products to McDonald's. But,
No.
but you know, it's good to have some things that you can sell more affordably, and you know, it's good to have a mix. What I really want to ask you right now, something I had started to get into earlier, and we got off on a tangent, but you know, talk to me about storytelling for our digital age, because clearly you've been telling me stories all this afternoon. You're telling stories on YouTube. I'm looking through your Instagram. It's all storytelling. And any marketer today would say, you know, that's like a critical skill. But how have you always been a storyteller? Did you have to learn how to tell stories? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I don't. I guess I've always been. I don't know. It's interesting. You kind of throw me a curve. I didn't. I guess I've never really considered myself much of a storyteller, but I've always enjoyed communicating.
Let me ask you, can I bring it back to law enforcement? That obviously, if you're interacting with the public and you're trying to get a good outcome, being able to communicate with someone is better than. Than not? Is that part of it?
Yeah, I think so. And again, I've always had a fair command of the language. I don't, that doesn't mean I sound, I'm sure I sound like a backwoods hick, but my vocabulary is not Shakespearean by any means, but I've always been able to communicate thoughts written or spoken. I wrote really outstanding police reports at the police department I worked at. And yeah, in fact, you may find this interesting, and I hope it's meaningful. You may not if you're not familiar with law enforcement very much, but my favorite types of calls to go on as a police officer was the dreaded domestic disturbance. Because not that I enjoyed seeing people in an uproar, but I seem to have a capability to, I don't want to say bring peace. I certainly couldn't resolve anybody's marital issues in a 15 or 30 minute police visit, but I had the ability to decelerate. I had the ability to communicate reason in a situation where tempers or whatever may have had reason banished. So, you know, I don't know. I also had one of my lieutenants, my favorite compliment just about that anybody has ever paid me, because I had never thought about it. It hadn't dawned on me until he told it to me. I was a sergeant at the time in uniform patrol, and a sergeant is kind of a tweener. You know,
yeah.
You're not really administration. You're not really a road guy. You're kind of in between. And he told me one time, he said, "Tommy, I've never seen anybody be able to do something that I've watched you do for a long time here at this police department, which is you are able to communicate the administrative positions to the men beneath you truthfully and without bias and clearly, and turn right around and communicate the positions of the men beneath you to the administration and sound like you believe both of them." You know, I don't remember exactly what he said, but, you know, I was able to communicate to both the sometimes contradictory positions without sounding aggressive, without being threatening. And I'd never really. He was right. I did that. I don't mean to say he was right about how well I did it. That sounds horrible. But I mean, he was right that was something that I did often. I found myself in a position of doing those things and fairly representing the positions of the other without, I don't know. So,
well, I'd say that's a key aspect of storytelling is understanding your audience and respecting them, yet, you know, I to me, there's two kinds of dramas. There's the drama where everybody's dysfunctional and going nowhere fast, maybe going to a very dark place. And there's the other kind of drama that the interest in the drama comes from people actually doing the hard work to get to somewhere good.
Yeah.
And that's kind of rewarding to watch that kind of drama.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But that's, you know, being able to share critical aspects, difficult to communicate concepts or concerns to different audiences is, you know, what we need in this world, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never thought about that skill in terms of storytelling, but you're right. I've never thought about that in terms of understanding your audience, but you know, I guess that's exactly it. And so bringing it back to the point of our discussion today, I guess based on the comments that I get on my videos, I begin to have an image in my head. I hope it's right. I hope it's the correct image of who my audience is on YouTube. And so I'm speaking to them in my videos. So, and this is not very, you know, there are guys out there whose YouTube channels are far, far more successful than mine. And it's probably because they spend a lot more time than I do planning and thinking it. Look, if they spend
or they're 19 years old and
Well, maybe.
Symmetrical faces.
Yeah, maybe so. But the guys I'm thinking about, there are some guys who do what in the genre that I'm in.
Okay.
Who do a lot of planning, and I should probably do that, but I don't have time. And so my YouTube channel is almost a fly by the pants kind of thing. But I'm beginning to understand who my audience is and telling stories. And you've given me, I'm so thankful for our time together because you've given me a new, context to describe what it is that I do. I never really thought about it, telling stories, but that's what we're doing. And so I'm telling stories to people that I know want to hear them. And it sort of shapes how we do things and how a video may turn out. And there's very little editing. I do some editing. There are some videos that call for editing and add some text. Usually when I say something wrong, that I have to put an overlay, said, nope, that was wrong. Should have said this, you know, but a lot of the videos are raw. Shoot them with my iPhone 6, use YouTube Capture, send them right up.
Well, that's, you know, that, again, there's different styles of video. And one of the problems with editing is that once you start, you kind of have to really go full in. I mean, I know there's different ways of, you know, farming and cropping and rotation and stuff. And there's ways that are just more natural. Like you're talking about your American guinea hogs that you just let them root around. You know, that's low level. If you were going to start feeding them and containing them, then, you know, it's a lot of work. So, but I think that authenticity that comes from a sort of a one take or just a couple of take shot, when done well, you know, just rings true because, you know, we're at least subconscious. We know when something's been edited.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, video quality has to, there's a threshold of video quality that people care about. And luckily for me, the iPhone 6 meets it or exceeds it most of the time. Audio is important. You know, there are times when I forget to use a lavalier and the wind gusts will come and it just sounds horrible. And there are times I try to edit that out. There are other times I send it up and say it with a sincere apology. You know, I'll put some text on the video. I'm so sorry about this wind. Wasn't prepared. You know, forgive me. And you know what? My audience forgives me because they're friends of mine, so to speak. You know, they feel like they are.
And you're acknowledging the flaw, you know.
Yeah, it's not and, like and you're right. I'm acknowledging, saying, boy, this sounds hard. You know, I'll say, ooh, that's bad, you know, or something. So, I mean, I really acknowledge it. And if any negative comments I get, usually it'll be from somebody I've never heard of. You know, I'm not calling them a troll in this instance because they're right. You know, it sounds horrible. It shouldn't be there. Now, I do get mad at the guys, not mad, frustrated with the people that complain about a rooster crowing in the background. I mean, hello, I live on a farm, you know, but what's great for me is if somebody comes on and comments about make the rooster shut up, I don't have to say anything. Other people chime in, dude, he's on a farm. It sounds great. You know? So I've actually got my little branded 2-second intro that YouTube puts on all of my videos is a rooster crowing for that very reason. That's a little inside joke. So if this podcast goes far and wide, my secret's out, you know, but the reason I made a rooster crow on the beginning of every video is because it seems like every time I go to do a video, a dadgum rooster crows, you know, so.
Well, I have a dog. She's got one trick. When I start to talk, she starts to snore. So I got to kick her out of the room for the podcast.
Listen, speaking of dogs, do you have time for another story?
Sure. I'm happy to. I'm enjoying this tremendously, Tommy.
This is so funny. In my very first video, the corner post video, and actually in at least one other of the fencing videos, I have a camouflage, a sack hanging around my neck that's made out of camouflage material. And in that sack is a chihuahua. her name was Little Bit. And when she died last year, or maybe 2 years ago now, but she was 18 years old. She had, and it's a funny, we had bred her mother, to sell some Chihuahua puppies. And when Little Bit was born, she had some kind of little deformity that she would, when she would nurse her mommy, milk would come out of her nose. She had some kind of little problem with the connection in her nasal passage. So we didn't sell her. And because we thought she'll never make it, she'll never survive. Well, 18 years later, you know, so she had gone, completely blind and completely deaf. And, she had become extremely dependent upon me. So I found that bag that Patty had made for one of the kids for something years ago. And I would wear that little dog around my neck the whole time I was up and awake at home. And near the end of her life, she slept with us in the bed. And because when she was near me, she was okay. And she knew me by smell. And when she wasn't near me, sometimes she would panic and she would squall. I mean, it was a horrible sound, probably because she was deaf at this point. So she did anyway. So, and when I'm doing the fence, I'm starting to do the post hole, for this corner post video. And I realized that it's putting a little bit in danger. I can't do the post hole digger, without slinging her around on my chest. Yep. So I hung her up in that sack on a fence behind where I was shooting and thought I was out. I thought I had her out of the frame. And so in between shots, this was an edited video. And in between shots, I would go over and talk to her and pet her. I talked to her, even though I knew she couldn't hear me, pet her and let her know everything was fine. She never let out a peep. So I'm editing this video and it was my first video and it took a couple of hours to do it because I had to complete the work, you know, of actually doing the post hole. In editing the video, there she is. She's in the frame on this post. And I thought, oh no. Well, maybe nobody will notice. Ha! I have gotten more comments about that little dog hanging on that fence on that one video than the actual method I was teaching itself. It's so funny. And so every so often to this day, is that a dog on the fence? What is that hanging in that sack behind you? You know, whatever. And so what I do is I scroll down through the comments and find the last time I explained it and copy and paste it into the new comment, you know. But it's actually gained me some subscribers because the story. Once I explain it, you know, people write back, oh my gosh, you're such a loving man, that little dog, you know, blah, blah, blah. But
you can make a little video and give them a link to the video.
Yeah. So it was so funny that, and I tell people that little dog has gotten more comments than the fence post. And,
but that's what it means to be out there and interacting with people and to be authentic and to
right,
be open.
That's right. Yeah. Yep.
I got to tell you a quick story.
Do.
One of the things I did back in 2010 and early 2011 is I spent some time in Vieques, Puerto Rico. I was finishing up my second master's and I was working at a hotel there. And it's a very strange place, but one of the wonderful things about it, we're talking about 2.5 feet or more of really rich, dark topsoil.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd set up little fences to keep the horses run wild there. They're not wild horses in that they don't have owners. It's just cheaper to let them out loose and spend time finding your horse when you want it. And they tend to stay around in a little group together. So you kind of know where they are most of the time.
Yeah.
So they had on the property, they had taken just, you know, they went into the jungle, so to speak, and cut down some, you know, saplings, you know, maybe a couple, 2-3 inches, you know, and it just staked these into the ground and ran some barbed wire along them. The soil was so rich, they started growing the fence posts. And I just think that's, you know, that's nature. Obviously, they're still green. They didn't dry them or cure them or anything. And
Obviously, that's what happens. But
that's great. That's great. I would kill for 2.5 feet of topsoil, man.
Yeah, it's the other side of it is that 2/3 of the island were used by the United States military for a long time. A third of it for bomb testing and bomb training. It was very critical to the country at that time, but it became a conflict for the island, and there was depleted uranium used, which wasn't supposed to have been used. They actually brought nuclear materials from the Pacific when they were done testing there, and they dumped them in the harbor. So there's all kinds of unfortunate things, but it's a very beautiful place, and it's much like it was when the Spaniards gave it up at the end of the Spanish-American War. It's really changed very little. Obviously, you know, there's some roads and electricity and all of that, but it's a very, very different from the rest of Puerto Rico, which is a bit more modern and a bit more upbuilt. But anyway, I had to share that. That's my my fence story, the posts funny. That grow themselves.
That's great. That's great. Reproducing posts.
Yeah. is there anything I can share with you? I mean, I think we're kind of coming to an end here, but.
Like I said, we're on YouTube. We have a website. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, but I don't have a podcast, Harry. A little interesting thing. For my New Year's resolution was to I had two New Year's resolutions. Resolution number one: wash the dishes. my wife, you know, she shouldn't have to do that all the time by herself. She doesn't, and we've got kids and they help. But I've done it occasionally. But I made it a New Year's resolution to make it my job to wash the dishes, and so that's going pretty well. When I'm at home, I do it. And then the other one was. I am an information addict. I constantly watching the news, reading the news. Drudge was my homepage, you know, the nice aggregation of sources and whatnot. And I said, and we watched a lot of Fox News in our house. And I'll tell you, Dish Network kind of helped me. Think of this idea, because there was a recent contractual disagreement between Dish and Fox News. And so they were off the air for a few weeks. And one day I kind of noticed I felt better. or I guess maybe I noticed really that I hadn't noticed, you know, that I hadn't missed it. And I thought, you know what? I don't want to cloister myself. I don't want to crawl under a rock, but I want to get the news when I want it. And so I went on Facebook and unfollowed every national news outlet or pundit or whatever. And I followed them all. Unfollowed. Did the same thing on Twitter. Unfollowed them all. And so the long and the short of it is, as a result of that, when I'm having to travel, we haven't mentioned, I still have, for full disclosure, I still have a full-time job. I'm not a full-time farmer yet. And I work in a public safety software industry, and I have to travel a little bit in state and in the region. And so because I had made this commitment to not be bombarded by news sources, I needed something to listen to. When I drive, because I like to listen. My wife doesn't like anything on in the car when we drive. But I like, if I'm by myself, to hear something. So I started listening to podcasts. I found several that were having to do with farming, having to do with, I love Freakonomics, the Freakonomics podcast. And so now I'm going to be listening to yours, because I've got a new podcast to add.
We're talking now in February of 2015. I don't have a release date for the show on the FIR podcast network. Obviously, if you're listening to this, it's probably out already, but at some point they will give you the go ahead.
Either that or you work for the NSA.
Nope. Yes. I do have my own show called talkingaboteverything.com, which is a very, very mixed bag. It's intended that people
for the most part, may not want to subscribe to it because one show may be completely different from another. But this will, especially this raw and uncut, if you're listening this far in to our conversation, this is going to be living there as well. That first 25 minutes is going to be the primary part that will go on the FIR podcast network. But that's a network that deals a lot with marketing and communications. And it's aimed at largely professional communicators. You may call them PR people, but it's more than PR, but it's people who work internally within an organization or externally and help them with their communications messages, which cool. That's your job at Alderman Farms besides whatever every other job that you have on the farm.
Yeah, that's but, right. That's right.
But so, you are a communication expert.
Yeah, well, expert or no, I mean, that is the role that I find myself in. So back to your question is, do I have a question for you? Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we're missing. We don't have a podcast, and we could do a podcast. And so, give me some tips. I was waiting for you to accept my connection request online to do this, I was doing a little research about recording these calls, and I've seen a couple of options that I need to explore once we disconnect or later this evening or sometime. But
there's a bunch of ways of doing it. There is no sort of YouTube of podcasting beyond maybe iTunes, but about 80-90% of people who subscribe through iTunes. And so where things you can do on a YouTube video to be searched and found the way you described, people were searching for fencing or got referred to your fencing video after watching another video about fences. And I've had lots of conversations about fences today, which is literally did come up in another interview. But iTunes, getting on iTunes and being part of that is where most things are found.
Yeah.
YouTube and Google are not very podcast friendly. And the downside also is that the statistics that you get on YouTube, the way you can put something up and you can see if somebody has watched the whole thing mm-hmm. or just a part of it,
mm-hmm.
and you can see the same on Facebook, doesn't exist really in the podcast world.
Really?
And so the only really good metric that you can get is subscribers. There are ways, there's some rather unsavory ways. People will just post things hundreds of times a day on Twitter. There's a lot of bots that watch Twitter. They'll click on any link, mm-hmm. and it can make it look like you're getting hundreds and hundreds of downloads when in fact you're not. You're not even getting a listen. Understanding that the statistics are a lot worse, there are two major hosting companies. There's LibSync, LibSyn for Liberated Syndication. And then there's a company called Blueberry. It's not quite spelled that way. And that's the other major host. They both offer statistics. One of the interesting things is, you know, you might think, you know, obviously like in farming that a big cost is the food, but sometimes dealing with the waste product or properly handling it can be a bigger cost. In podcasting, you might think a big cost is the hosting, actually transmitting the files. But the definition of a podcast is something that's distributed through an RSS feed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a feed that people can subscribe to. Those feeds get hit so many times an hour when people are searching and stuff mm-hmm. that the amount of data that gets transmitted for some shows is much more just their very short little RSS feed, which might be, you know, a couple kilobytes or something, than the whole shows. So anyway, it's
wow.
Something that's worth doing, you know, with a good host. There are options like SoundCloud, which is free, and there's some other ones. My recommendation is Libsyn, because that's who I use. I am not happy with everything that they do, but the reason that I use them is that they're very fast on customer service. You know, within a
day or two, sometimes much sooner. But they have a fantastic relationship with Apple. And so they really make sure that they understand and communicate what you need to do in your setting up your podcast to rank and to be part of iTunes. iTunes is the largest podcast search engine, and it's a large search engine in its own right.
Sure.
So, you know, you're talking anywhere from about $5 to $20 a month for the hosting. When you get more than 5 or 10,000 downloads a month, you can start to get into, you know, potential ad revenue. But at any point, you can sell your own sponsors. So you may be able to tap your Carbon Media. Maybe they might even have someone who's looking to get involved with audio. On the production side, that's another kind of question. You know, a lot of folks on Macs use GarageBand. I happen to be on Linux, or people on Windows may use a free program called Audacity. It also runs on the Mac.
Yeah, I'm actually familiar with Audacity.
You know, so I find audio editing to be very easy. I use a company called Auphonic. I do some very basic editing on my show, and I upload it to Auphonic. Auphonic does all of the final processing. There's a loudness standard. If your voice gets is softer than mine, or my voice gets really soft, Auphonic will level that all out and will make the whole thing conform to the standard. It's not a regulated standard, but it's a suggested standard for this medium. It's a loudness units. The standard is kind of geeky, but it's -16 LUFS. And but the other thing that Auphonic does is it will let you pre-record an intro and an outro. I mean, you do that on your own, but right. It will attach it to the beginning and the end of your file.
Nice.
It will make different resolutions. So, you know, you generally want to do like a 56K MP3, but you might want a high resolution WAV file or some other file for your records. And then on the end of the processing, it can automatically submit it to Libsyn, or it could upload it to Google Drive or Dropbox or something. So the real question then becomes on the microphone side. There are two general categories of mics. There's condenser mics and there's dynamic mics. The dynamic mics need extra gain, but they're very good at filtering out background noise.
Yeah.
Condenser mics are these marvelous, really rich microphones, but they're meant for a quiet little studio.
Yeah.
And you start to need all kinds of other gear to get them to work. You need limiters and you need compressors and all this kind of thing. If I didn't have this mic EQ'd and condensed and have something called a low cut filter as well, if I didn't have any of that on this, it would be sounding horrible right now. So the basic thing that I would say to get started, it's very simple. It's going to cost you $65. You get an ATR 2100. It's a dynamic mic. It has a USB connection. So you need to, you know, hopefully you can get a way to get that into your computer. And it has a standard mic connection, an XLR connection. Mm-hmm. So later when you grow into something more expensive in terms of gear, you can continue to use that mic. And that's it. You record into Audacity, you do a little bit of editing to suit your needs, send it to Auphonic, and you're done. That's probably the easiest way to do it. And then when you start to get into interviewing people this remotely, then it gets a lot more complicated. But there's some companies coming out with technology that will record on both sides, where right now we're only recording on my side.
Interesting.
So I don't know if that was too much information or.
Well, it was a lot of information, which prompts me to say, Harry, would you kindly email me those company names?
Absolutely.
Yeah. If you'll send me that information in an email, man, I'd be grateful.
That's great. And you know, like I said, one of these days I'd love to taste some of that American guinea hog.
Absolutely.
I'm very friendly with some of the local barbecue guys in New York. New York has developed an amazing love and high quality of barbecue.
Really?
And but it sounds like something that might even be too good for the barbecue, for the smoker. And so it'd be interesting. I know a few higher end chefs and something to even think about, because I have cooked there a few times. Well, you can certainly Google them. There's the James Beard House, mm-hmm. which is a very well-known place to come cook and show off ingredients and things. And it might be interesting to get a bunch of local chefs, or bring up a chef from Mississippi as well, or all Mississippi chefs.
There's one that's been there. The chef I mentioned that we've developed a relationship with, his name is Nick Wallace, Chef Nick Wallace. And he has cooked at the Beard House.
And, so, you know, I would talk to him about going back and tell him you'll supply him with some guinea hogs and come up and bring some of the rest of your produce into an Alderman Farms dinner. And he probably has all of the connections and whatnot. But if I.
Yeah, sounds good to me. That may be a road trip.
It'd be a good field trip for the kids. It's a great way to highlight all of your stuff in kind of the sanctuary, the temple of food in America, which is the Beard House. But also it's a great place to tell stories. It's a great place to capture content and to show off your produce and products and all of that in a different light. So
interesting. That's one reason we love this guy, is because he loves the story of the food that he prepares, and he tells it, you know, when he prepares it. And another reason I love him is he has a tattoo of a pig.
It can't be the only one. That's great.
No, that's right.
Well, Tommy, I think we're coming to an end here. I hope that we can chat again. I can think of a whole bunch more questions for you. And I'd certainly, as your journey on YouTube grows and changes, I did have one last kind of technical question, if you're allowed to talk about it, which is can you talk about the length of your relationship with Carbon Media? Like, are you locked in for a certain amount of time, or can you talk about anything about that?
Yeah. Forgive me, because I can't remember exactly, but I think we did have to sign, and I frankly don't remember if it was a 1 year or a 2 year contract. They actually redid it before the first one was over, when they came out with a new revenue sharing plan that offered a static guaranteed CPM. And but, you know, they've I asked them, that was one of the things that bothered me. Well, what if I have a better offer? You know, what if I don't like it or something? And they said, well, you know, we're not going to chase you down. And they basically said, you know, their pitch was, we don't know, because nobody's ever we've never had anybody try to get out. And I can't imagine wanting to get out. I'm so I'm so tickled to have a direct connection to the YouTube gurus. I guess indirect through them, that it's worth the whole deal. Just if I wasn't making anything, I would stick with them, simply because I know if I have a question I need answered from the YouTube mothership, you know, that the Carbon Media folks have their emails, you know. I don't know this to be true. I would assume that most of the network offerings, there's some kind of contract term involved.
Yes, I believe so.
So,
I haven't personally looked into them. You know, I know that they're, you know, something that I need to research as part of this show. And,
tell you, there's some that are spam bots or something. You know, it's so funny. I still get them. I still get emails or messages in my YouTube inbox. Hey, saw your videos. We love what you're doing, and we think you would be a perfect fit. And it's some kind of Xbox group, you know, or some, you know, some kind of gamer thing. And I'm thinking, gosh, why are you? And delete. Just hit the delete button. And so that was one of the things that that drew me to Carbon Media, although coincidentally, they were also among the first to reach out to us, is it was true. We were a fit. You know, they had this outdoor hub and they this ag hub that sort of aggregated similar type content to what we were doing. So it was a fit, you know, but and I get inquiries from others that seem legit in the sense that they seem to know who we are, you know, but more often than not, it's some kind of blanket thing. And, you know, we think you're a perfect match, and it has nothing to do, you know, it's women's shoes or something. So they need to do a little bit better job on their marketing.
That's in the a lot of, who knows if anyone's listening this far in, but a lot of the professional communicators and the folks who receive sort of pitches from them and stuff, you know, that, I mean, it's just common that people send this stuff out and they don't take the time to really try to understand who they're talking to.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it doesn't work, you know, but the people who take the time and do the research, you know, it works well. I guess I'll ask you, did you have a lawyer look at the agreement at all, or you just signed it?
No, I didn't have a lawyer look at it.
Well, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's clear that, you know, you're not 19, you're not trying to become a YouTube star and not have to do anything but that for the rest of your life. It's an augmentation to your business, and right, that you can make some money on it and build your brand. You know, it seems incongruous that a small farm in Mississippi could be known all around the world.
Yeah.
But that's our world.
That's the world we live in.
And, you know, I guess I'll leave it there. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, it's been, as we say in Mississippi, it has been a hoot, which translation, I've really enjoyed this. It's been fun. And I hope you're serious when you say we could do it again sometime. I'd love that.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot more story to tell. And
I could fill up 2 hours just talking about guinea hogs, probably.
Well, for my podcast, talking about everything.
Yeah,
that's one of the topics that I'd love to talk about, and we can go on forever on that.
Woohoo!
So promises,
you know, promises.
You can use the link that you used to set this up anytime you just want to set up a time, and we'll talk. So that's an open invitation. Just, you know, Make an appointment when you have the time, and we're not keeping you from the chickens.
Okay.
when I was 16, I had my first used car, which was a 1970 Impala, which was about 4,400 pounds, and I felt it needed more weight. For the winters in New Hampshire, I went to the local Agway store. I assume you may know Agway. It's a farm, product store. And I basically said to the guy, what's the cheapest thing that comes in 100-pound bags? And I got 3 bags of chicken grit for $20.
That's great. That's great.
So one over the transmission and 2 in the trunk. But got me through the winters. Anyway, this is Harry Hawk. You can find me on Twitter at HHAWK. I'd love to hear from you. I'm sure Tommy would like to hear from you. You can find him everywhere, and he'll tell you where.
Alderman Farms, no spaces or hyphens. And I got to tell you, there is another Alderman Farms in Florida. It's an organic vegetable growing thing, but I beat him to the punch. And so it's Facebook/Alderman Farms, Twitter @Alderman Farms, Instagram @Alderman Farms, Pinterest the same, and YouTube is also Alderman Farms.
Well, if you're down in Mississippi, you know where to get your eating chickens and your dairy goats.
That's right.
This is Harry Hawk for Tommy and everyone saying, I hope you have a great week. Thanks for listening this far, and I hope to hear from you soon. Bye-bye. And we're out. Thank you. I'm going to drop the call, but Tommy, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I hope I didn't ramble too much for you.
No, this is exactly
I need to do an interview to kind of get to someplace, but
yeah.
Then I this is an experiment for me. I don't know how many people will ever go to this, you know, hour and 43 minute podcast. And, mm-hmm. but to me, it's this long tail content that someone will want to know about these topics and they'll find this. And if not, I've got my nice little tight 25-30 minute interview, and we're all good. Again, I did post some links through to the Skype, so you should have all those links right in there.
Okay, very good.
But feel free to ask me questions. There's a fantastic community on Google Plus all about podcasting. I would tell you to avoid paying for any kind of consulting or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you decide it's what you want to do for a business.
No. It's just going to be a companion thing, you know. Yeah. And our website, which needs some work, but I use Weebly. Now I've got my own domain, you know, so it's not Weebly dot. It's www.aldermanfarms.net. But I've actually this afternoon looked up and I can host them through there. I've got a pro account with them.
Right. What you want to do is two things. You want to do the actual media hosting on Libsyn, but you want to host the blog and potentially the RSS feed. But I would urge you probably to leave the RSS feed at Libsyn.
Okay.
But basically, put the blog that goes with the podcast on your existing site.
Okay.
And right now, and this may change, but right now, if it's aldermanfarms.net/blog, you'll get much better SEO results than if it's blog dot.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, we actually have a blog that has been dormant because I just don't have time. What it is. It's aldermanfarms.net/blog.
Great. So you're just going to start adding podcast episodes to that. And if you want, I am not an expert on RSS feeds, but again, that's really the reason I went with Libsyn, because they really manage that, in my opinion, very well. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have a technical relationship with my podcast.
Right.
you know, and they have a great relationship with Apple, and you'll need some artwork, and that's about it. You can just get going and start doing it, and think about the length of time of, you know, and just be consistent about putting them out. And you can do video. There are video podcasts, but you're already doing YouTube. So yeah. I don't know, you know, if that makes sense. But I think it's just you talking and you know, if you start interviewing people, that's another kind of a thing. But whatever you do, you can basically get started for $5 a month, your existing web hosting, and a $65 mic.
Wow.
And you will learn more doing that than buying $1,000 worth of gear.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And when you want, you can spend all the money in the world on it. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of crazy gear.
Yeah, I'm good at spending money. Thank God for my wife. I'd be I would be penniless if it wasn't for her.
Well, thank Patty. And again, it was a pleasure. And feel free, like I said, schedule something anytime you want for talking about anything. And if you have any podcast questions, shoot me an email. I will either answer you or suggest somebody who may know the answer better than I
will. I will. And be sure, you know, to send me the link, you know, to promote it, and send me anything you want me to promote of yours. And I'm happy to retweet and post it on Facebook. You know, hey, y'all go check out my new friend who does this. I mean, whatever.
I appreciate that. Same here. Anything I can do. I've enjoyed this very much. So,
yep, it was a hoot. Thanks, Harry.
Thank you, Tommy. Bye-bye.
Have a good night.
My name is Chuck Fresh, and I am being paid to thank you for listening to Talking About Everything with Harry Hawk. Harry wants to hear from you on Twitter at HHawk or HarryHawk@gmail.com. And now, a word from our sponsor, Life Extension Coach and favorite chef. Hawk Digital Marketing is focused on bringing brands and people together We build communities of interest based on trust and transparency, where consumers and brands can converse, learn, discuss, or solve problems together, while creating a long-term connection, entanglement, between you and your customers. Once connected, we help you engage, communicate, sell, present, educate, and inform. Evolve your communications with us. HawkSocialMarketing.com.